I'm joined today from New York by Dan Doktoroff, Chief Executive of Sidewalk Labs, the urban innovation arm of Google's parent company Alphabet, previously the CEO and President of Bloomberg and Deputy Mayor for Economic Development and Rebuilding for the City of New York. Dan also led New York City's bid for the 2012 Summer Olympics. And during his first term as Deputy Mayor, Doktoroff oversaw 289 separate projects and initiatives, including the rezoning of 6,000 city blocks and the creation of 130 million square foot of residential and commercial space. No stranger to urban development, you've been heading up Sidewalk Labs since its inception in 2015. And the company mantra of reimagining cities to improve quality of life has seen Sidewalk Labs, among other things, tackle the complex, complicated and multifaceted challenge of building a city from the internet up. As many and hopefully even most people will now know, this has been put into practice on an 800-acre site in Toronto in Canada, one of the biggest of its kind in North America, working with Waterfront Toronto to deliver a new kind of mixed use complete community on Toronto's eastern waterfront, beginning with the creation of Quayside. So, Dan, thank you so much for joining us today. Sidewalk Toronto has been described as a project that will combine forward thinking, urban design and new digital technology to create people-centered neighborhoods that achieve precedent-setting levels of sustainability, affordability, mobility and economic opportunity. That's quite a thing to be delivering, and presumably, in essence, this is the practice, ultimately, of building a city from the internet up. And what exactly does that mean, building a city from the internet up?
Well, what that really means is that we now, in the beginning of the 21st century, have a new set of tools, which are largely digital tools, that enable us to innovate across virtually every aspect of the urban environment, from mobility to infrastructure and sustainability to the way buildings are built, the way the public realm is experienced, even sort of our social infrastructure. And what you recognize when you kind of work a lot in cities is that all those different systems work together. So what we're really trying to do is take advantage of a set of innovations that are uniquely available right now to think about the city and its future at a time in which obviously more and more people are moving into cities and our need to use the resources we have more efficiently is growing greater and greater every day. So it's really just about can we combine cutting edge technology and great urban design to dramatically improve quality of life?
I presume that you fully believe the answer to that question is yes.
We absolutely do, and you know, that was a hypothesis when we started Sidewalk Labs with Alphabet back in 2015. Since then, we've done an enormous amount of work to try and test that hypothesis. We brought in experts from all over the world. We looked at every attempt to create sort of a so-called smart city. We cataloged virtually every urban innovation out there. We tested it against sort of real world situations, and now obviously focused on Toronto. And every bit of work that we have done has convinced us that it is absolutely doable. It is not easy. There are a lot of hurdles to overcome, but we would not be making this investment and spending, you know, this critical part of each of our careers, as well as engaging the way we are with the public, particularly in Toronto and Canada, if we didn't believe it was possible.
I think at this point it'd be really interesting to just take a little bit of a step back before we go into the, you know, sort of delve into it really, and talk a little bit about you, because from private equity and government to what is arguably now the best known startup in the world, like, what pushed you to set up Sidewalk Labs with Google in 2015, and how did that arrangement even come about?
So I, after leaving government, went to run Bloomberg LP for 7 years. And, you know, when Mike Bloomberg decided to come back to the company and get more involved after he finished being mayor, I decided that I didn't really want to go back and be his deputy mayor, at least on a de facto basis again. And so even though our relationship was and continues to be great, I just thought, you know, maybe at 56 years old, it was time to do another thing that would be more my own. And I've been thinking a lot about sort of technology and cities, and not surprisingly, sort of this notion of combining them, actually on some level combines the last two phases of my career, because Bloomberg itself is one of the largest technology companies, if not the largest, in New York. And I have this hypothesis that we're at sort of this critical moment in urban history, not unlike sort of the three previous technology-driven urban revolutions that had occurred over the last couple hundred years, you know, like the steam engine in the early part of the 19th century, the electric grid in the late part of the 19th century, and the automobile in the early part of the 20th century, all of which really dramatically shaped the urban environments that we live in now. I sort of suspected that the sort of digital age would have the same sort of impact. I mean, in reality, our cities haven't changed a whole lot since the automobile was fully rolled out through our metropolitan areas by the, you know, early 1940s or so. And so little did I know that Larry Page, the CEO of Google and now Alphabet, had been thinking the same thing and been thinking about it very deeply for a very long time, and had always had this desire to think about, well, what would happen if you combine these technologies with great design? And so we had got together. In fact, I got an email out of the blue from Eric Schmidt that the ray on it was the city of the future, question mark. And so he introduced us, and we just spent several months talking about kind of how we each felt about it, what different hypotheses might be for what that place might be or what was actually possible, and decided to create Sidewalk Labs in the summer of 2015.
And how different is what you're proposing with Sidewalk Toronto specifically to the urban design and development and master planning as we know it already?
Well, I think it's actually going to be both familiar and very different. I mean, look, at the end of the day, the principles that make cities great don't change. You know, cities are about people, and we always have to remember that when we improve the experience of people in cities, we improve the city. And that, so those principles essentially are timeless. And the question is, how can you use tools to actually improve that experience? How can you use the tools that are now available to us to improve quality of life? At the end of the day, this is never about technology. Technology is just a means to actually helping people to lower the cost of living, to gain more convenience so that time-starved parents have more time with their children, to improve health outcomes, to improve the environmental qualities of a place, to enhance safety, to improve the sense of community. And so at the end of the day, all we're trying to do is enhance what makes cities great in the first place and eliminate what makes them not so great. You know, one of the ways we express this often is, you know, in some ways, cities are about friction. There's bad friction. Bad friction are things like congestion and pollution, the externalities that make living in cities bad. Then there's positive friction. Positive friction is serendipity. It is diversity. It's having new kinds of experiences that you otherwise wouldn't be able to have. We sort of see our job and the role of finding a way to combine sort of design and innovation as to eliminate as much as possible the bad friction and preserve and enhance the good friction.
And lots of people have been talking about the idea of building a city from the internet up, coming from the sorts of things that you would instantly think of, I think, particularly somebody that's not heavily involved in it. So people are talking about data and sensors. And does it go much further than that, and would you like
to? I I actually think the notion of, sort of the data, which has been a big focus of attention on this project, is really kind of misses the point. If you look at what we've been proposing, and we've now started to release many more elements of our plan, most of it has nothing to do with that. I'll give you an example of that. In the first phase of this project, we're proposing that the vast majority, if not all, of the building stock actually be wood buildings, mass timber buildings, a relatively new technology that I think offers extraordinary environmental benefits, and more importantly can meaningfully lower the cost of buildings and therefore enable us, for example, to produce more affordable housing and create a far more mixed income community than would typically be found, say, in a downtown area like the one that we're talking about in Toronto. You know, while to some extent the technology and the ability to create greater efficiencies uses information and new kind of data-driven technologies to achieve those efficiencies, for the most part, what we're doing is laminating wood in a different way, having a factory to actually produce it and create a supply chain that enables us to do that much more quickly and efficiently. That you would not call sort of a city from the internet up. You'd say that's just new technology innovating often on old technology to produce hopefully radically new results. So the vast majority of things that we're talking about actually fall into that category. And so, so we don't really focus on things like sensors. The other thing I should point out, though, is that we do take the question of data and privacy incredibly seriously. Just a couple of months ago, after months and months of consultation and debate, we proposed an urban data policy that we think is a huge leap forward in terms of the way data collected in public or semi-public spaces can actually be managed. People never would have expected us to propose that we shouldn't be the entity that actually manages the data or oversees it, that we actually should be subjected, like everybody else who does work in this place, to the same set of rules that would be governed by an independent civic data trust, because we do believe that we're going to have to find ways as we move into the future of managing that data to ensure that everyone feels comfortable with the ways in which data is actually used. So that while we don't think of this place as being driven at the end of the day by sensors and data, we do think that they can add extraordinary value in terms of achieving those quality of life objectives, but they have to be managed very, very carefully.
Okay. And in terms of a rollout then, and there's sort of four kind of wide objectives with the Toronto scheme, as far as I can see, and the last two of those, which are make Toronto the global hub of a rising new industry of urban innovation and serve as a model for sustainable neighbourhoods throughout Toronto and cities around the world. They're obviously Toronto specific until you get to the around the world part. So how is that rollout going to work, and what are the next steps? I mean, obviously there's a lot to do.
Well, our focus right now really is on Toronto, right now we are in the last couple months of putting together what we call a master innovation and development plan, and that will be this comprehensive basically plan to demonstrate how you might build this place on this specific location on the waterfront right near downtown Toronto. And it will go into incredible detail, not just on the physical plan, but on the innovations and how the innovations ultimately get meshed together with the actual physical environment. It'll also talk about the experience, the hope of living there, but also the novel type of deal that we would craft with government as our partners, and that is really important. We're not seeking to impose in any way sort of our will on the public or on government. This has to be a partnership where we work hand in hand with multiple levels of government in order to craft something that is uniquely appropriate for the people of Toronto and of Canada. So we'll release that plan over the next few months, and when we do, we'll then go through an approval process. Approvals will have to be gained at all three levels of government, as well as with our main partner, an entity called Waterfront Toronto, which actually is charged with developing the waterfront in Toronto. And it, in turn, is sort of a body that represents the three levels of government. We expect that will take sort of most of this year. And, you know, if we work effectively, if we get the kind of support we hope we will get, we might be in a position to start construction later in 2020. But there's a lot of hurdles. When we signed up for this, we didn't have any guarantee of approvals. The approvals are going to be a really interesting mix of land use approvals and regulatory forbearances in order to achieve some of the innovation approaches. And so we're going to be working really hard with our government partners this year to kind of make this a reality. Now, assuming we are able to succeed in Toronto, then over time, obviously, there'll be opportunities to do things in other places. But our focus right now is in Toronto.
Would you say that some of the biggest barriers that you are, that you think you're going to have to overcome will be down to those approvals that you mentioned?
I think that's true, and I think a precursor to the approvals is it's never easy to explain the future. And to be honest, we don't have all the answers to the future, and we're not proposing that we have all the answers. What we're proposing is to create sort of a flexible framework with enough detail and early actions that others can create on top of what we actually catalyze. We really do see ourselves in many ways as sort of a catalyst to the creation of the first 21st century district.
I mean, that's so interesting on so many levels, and it leads me on to one of my questions, which was, given that this is an entirely new way of approaching master planning, even though you said that some of it will be familiar, do you think that real estate developers and master planners, as they have been up to this point, have a future?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you know, when we look at sort of this site, our expectation is we're not going to be the actual physical developer of the vast majority of it. In fact, you know, the role we want to play as catalyst is really to demonstrate to the private market how innovation actually makes financial business sense for them, as well as obviously prove that these innovations can be deployed successfully to government and the public as well. So we understand that it will only be successful if we set the stage for innovation, that we prove to others that it achieves their objectives, but at the end of the day, this will be successful because others believe it, and that puts an entire premium on us to demonstrate it, both in terms of the way we explain it, but as importantly, in the way in which we actually prove that the innovations actually can be successful.
You've had a lot of high-profile and, I would imagine, high-pressure roles in your career, but this is quite something to form a blueprint, if you like, or as you call it, the catalyst, for other people to build on.
I have to say, I probably had not really a very good sense of what I was getting myself into. This is by far the most complicated thing that I have ever worked on, and I'm sitting here right now as I talk to you in my office on the 27th floor of 10 Hudson Yards, which is overlooking what is becoming America's largest ever development, a project that I worked on and spearheaded in my time in government. And on many levels, this is more complicated.
And how do you feel about it when you look out over the, you know, that project that you spearheaded, and you think about what it is that you've signed up to in terms of delivery in Toronto? Do you have sleepless nights, or are you?
Well, the one thing that I have learned is that these things take time. If there was one lesson I learned from my time in government, is that to do these big, complicated projects, you have to master the art of operating at two speeds at the same time. You have to be incredibly patient and respectful, because process matters a lot, and there are a lot of people who have to be touched in a complicated process. At the same time, you have to act with a sense of urgency, because if you don't, then these big things die of their own weight. And bringing that skill to bear will be absolutely critical for us to be successful in Toronto. In fact, you know, really one of the core values for us at Sidewalk Labs is we need to have people who can be both patient and urgent at the same time.
And I know I'm conscious of your time. I've got sort of a couple more questions. I mean, that sort of people who be patient and urgent at the same time is a really interesting one. And what would be really interesting to know is how you found it working with other people, because what it is that you guys have done is you've taken a hugely collaborative approach to development and master planning, and actually real estate isn't always known for excelling in that area. And how have you found that, and how do you think you'll continue to find that going forward, that collaboration working together?
Well, we have to address that on two levels. You know, one is on the inside of our company, and said we have to be really careful to find people who are capable of acting at two speeds at the same time. And that's hard when you're bringing together a set of disciplines where the norm is not always to act that way. And so the way in which we've brought together our team has been not without mistakes from time to time, but has been very focused on kind of finding people who meet that standard, and also people who can cross what we call the urbanist-technologist divide. You know, there's a reason the smart city movement hasn't been very successful, and in part it is because technologists don't understand cities, and urbanists typically don't understand technology, so we've had to work very hard to kind of bring that team together. The second level, obviously, is everyone else you deal with, and that people operate in very different ways, and we have to listen very carefully. We have to communicate effectively. We don't always get it right, but I think we're making progress.
And how do you think that people will ultimately respond to this? Because there's been a bit of an initial reaction. There was a reaction of excitement and intrigue, I think. And then obviously there are some sort of concerns that are raised around privacy, which I think you've addressed. And it's sort of bedding down a bit now. And then people are asking questions and continuing to be very inquisitive about it. So it's a new concept for many people to get their head around as well. So how do you feel it being sort of taken on board by people?
I think in general, given the volume of information and the newness of it, we've been pleasantly surprised by the reaction. Not that all of it, as you point out, has been positive. But what we have found pretty consistently is the more we focus on the content, the better the reaction actually is. And the question is, can we get good enough in terms of communicating in order to give people a sense for kind of what it is, and can we be good enough at listening and then reflecting feedback in order to give people comfort that we will be a great long-term partner? You know, one of the statistics that I'm most gratified about in the last year or so that we've been engaged in Toronto is that we have literally touched, as of right now, in terms of public fora and meetings, both large and small, nearly 20,000 people. I can't think of a project that's ever had sort of this amount of public engagement. And we take the feedback that we get and we reflect it back into our plans. And if we continue to do that effectively, then I'm optimistic we can be successful.
I've got three quick
questions. I'm actually really got to run now.
I've got one question then, just one that I will just, the last question is that, do you expect this to be the urban, the kind of urban development that is the rule rather than the exception in years to come?
Well, things change slowly in urban environments. Part of the reason we wanted to do this is to set an example for the rest of the world. I'm very mindful of the fact that cities really like to copy the success of other cities. I remember that when we opened the High Line, another project that the Bloomberg administration spearheaded in 2008, within 1 year after its very successful launch, there were 36 High Lines under development around the world. That, by the way, continues to this day. And so if we're successful here, I think people will look to it for inspiration and as a model, maybe not for the whole thing, but for pieces, and that this will become a more accepted discipline. Already we're seeing lots of interest just based on what we're doing in Toronto.
Great. Dan, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for going 3 minutes over time. I know you're a very, very busy man. Much appreciated, and look forward to catching up soon.